I want to start out with a story that's not from a project where I am now, but actually when I was a kid. So this is me and the guy I call my brother. I grew up with them in their house all the time. Whenever I get out of school, I'd immediately go to their house. I never had any brothers and sisters of my own, so they became my brothers and sisters and adopted family. Anyway, so I grew up there. When I was about 9 years old, I don't think my parents actually have ever heard this story even. So when I was about 9 years old, I started thinking. And I started thinking, what is the purpose and what is the meaning of life? And I was, a particularly difficult math class probably helped with the morbid thoughts. But I started thinking, what is it really worth all of this? The little bit of joy that we get out of life, the little bit of enjoyment that we get out of life, is it really worth all the pain and all the suffering and all the, nasty stuff that goes on in the world? And, I kind of thought, it seems like life is just eat, sleep, reproduce, and die. And what's really the purpose in all of that? And I got really depressed at 9 years old. I didn't actually try anything, but I was, to the point where I was thinking, if that's all there is to life, then why keep on going? Why keep living? Might as well just fast forward the cycle right now and be done with it. But I thought to myself, well, wait a minute. There are 6 billion people in the world. At that time, it was just a little bit under 6 billion, but basically 6 billion people in the world. And they, I'm only 9 years old. Surely they're all thinking the same thing, the same thoughts. And they're not killing themselves. They must have found the answer to this. So I just need to hang on a little bit longer until I figure out what everybody else has figured out. And so I just kept on going with my life. I wasn't always depressed. I wasn't always, I wasn't always depressed. I had a fun, enjoyable childhood. But these thoughts kept coming back to me over and over until in my early teenage years. There was one night where, my very first communion service there in the village of Maiba. Mrs. White and Paul also talk about preparing your heart before communion service, reviewing your life, making sure there's nothing between you and God before you participate in the communion service. So one Friday night, I was kneeling in my bed, and I was praying. I was, going back over my life, trying to remember if there was anything, any unconfessed sins, any problems in my life, anything that was keeping me away from God that I needed to take care of. And as I did this, and as I asked for God's forgiveness, and by faith took hold of his promises that he had forgiven me and saved me, something changed. For the first time in my life, I had grown up in an Adventist home. I had heard about God all my life. I knew everything up here. But that night, for the first time, I heard him speaking to me, and I felt him. I felt that joy, joy that you don't find anywhere else in the world. There is nothing in the earth. I've experienced most different things that you can experience in the earth, and there is nothing that is anywhere near the joy that you feel when God touches you. And I felt that night, and I came to know God, not just know about him, but I came to know him. And it changed my life, and some of the stupidest things I've ever done happened after that. But ever since that point, I've always wanted to come back. I've always known that God was better, that I was happier when I was with God. And I found a purpose in life. I found the answer to that question that I started asking myself when I was 9 years old. What is the purpose of life? I found that there's something more to life. There's something more to aim for, more to, there's a saying that there's a heaven to gain and a hell to shun. And now I wanted that heaven. I found that there was something beyond this life to aim for. Well, as I continued to grow and continued to grow in my spiritual life as well, I found that not only is there something to aim for after this life, but here in the world where we are right now, there's a purpose for living. There's a purpose. There's a reason why we are still here in the world. It would be very, very simple for God to finish the work just like that. He could send the angels and finish it up. Why is it that he doesn't? Why is it that he waits for us? We have a purpose for being in the world. The reason that we are still here is not to make money. It's not to feed ourselves. It's not to enjoy life. God wants us to enjoy life. I'm not saying that's not something that we should strive for, but that's not the reason why we're still here. We could enjoy life a whole lot better in heaven than we can here. So why is it that we're still here? It's because God has given us a work. Remember, we are made in God's image, and part of being like God is participating in the process of bringing people to salvation. God has given us the honor and the privilege of being part of that work. The text that we just read, was read from the NIV. I actually translated this when I was in college. I don't like the most translations. I couldn't find it, though. I was looking for it. I can't find the old translation. I don't know my Greek well enough anymore. My Greek and Hebrew kind of left when I went back and learned Tobweed. So this is the Young's literal translation. It's about the best that I could find. So it says, having gone, then disciple all the nations, emphasis added, baptizing them to the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe whatever I did command you. What I want you to see from this is if you look in the original Greek of this passage, there is only one active verb. In the English, there are a bunch of active verbs, but in the Greek, there's only one. From that, can you tell what's the active verb there? Disciple, or make disciples. All the other verbs there, even the go, is actually supporting that. So in my translation, I do remember this, I said, going, make disciples. In the process of going, make disciples of all nations. Teaching them. When you make disciples, how do you make disciples? Well, you teach them to observe all the things that I've commanded you. And in the process of making disciples, then you baptize them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. But what we are called to do is to make disciples. And my friends, what a lot of Christians don't realize is that when you were baptized, when I was baptized, we signed on the dotted line that that would be our life work, that that would be our purpose in living here on this earth. If when you were baptized that wasn't made clear to you, I apologize on behalf of those that brought you to Christ, but that is our reason for being here on this earth still. That is why we're still here. And that is the work that God has given to every Christian. It's to make disciples. Now, does that mean that you need to go to the jungles of the Philippines to do that? Well, some people aren't answering the call. If you look at the statistics, 0.01% of Christians are doing that, and 2.2 billion people in the world have yet to hear the name of Jesus. Okay, that's not excluding the people who've heard about Jesus, who've heard the name, who've had some exposure to Christianity, but have rejected him, or don't know enough about him to choose. That's just the people that have no contact whatsoever. So there's some people that are definitely denying the call. But no, not everybody is called to go to the jungles of the Philippines. If so, and if everybody was called to be a pastor, who would keep the lights on? Who would make these wonderful gadgets that I can use to bring back and show pictures to y'all? Who would make the cars? Who would fly the planes? You know, the world would grind to a halt. We need all different kinds of people doing all different kinds of things, all different kinds of Christians doing all different kinds of work. But that doesn't mean that those Christians, that that's not their calling too, that this making disciples isn't their calling. If God has given you the talents to be a doctor, to be a nurse, to be a truck driver, to be a storekeeper, or a cashier or a clerk, use whatever talents God has given you. Use whatever career God has given you to make disciples. I want to tell you, in other careers, you're able to reach people that me as a missionary or a pastor would never be able to reach. First of all, oftentimes we don't have access to them, especially the upper classes. You know, you can't go knocking on their doors. They won't answer. And even if you do, they don't want to hear what a pastor has to say. But someone who works with them, especially, you know, living much of my life overseas and coming back, I found that, you know, Mayberry isn't true anymore. We can't, you know, our community here in America is not our neighbors anymore. Just from my own observation, our community here in America is the people we work with. Those are the people we have that we, you know, where we make our friends, where we have that community. And so it's those people, it's the people that you're working with that you're going to be able to reach most effectively. And you're going to be able to reach people that I never will be able to reach. There was one of the most effective church planters that I've ever known was a little man in India. He had no formal education whatsoever. You know, in India, they say that there are more bicycles than people there. And what he does is he sits by the edge of the road and he fixes people's bikes for pay. And as he's fixing people's bikes, he just drops a little hook, I guess you might say. He says something like, You know, I learned something fascinating about God this morning. And he stops. That's all he says. Now, if the person doesn't pick up on it, doesn't ask about it, doesn't say anything, well, he says, well, okay, that person isn't ready yet. But if the person asks about it and just says, well, what'd you learn? Well, then he gives a real short lesson, like, I learned that God created the world, he created the heavens and the earth, everything that we see, God is actually the one who made all that. And then he stops again. And if the person is interested and wants to talk with them, well, then he invites them to study the Bible with him. And when he studies the Bible with them, it's very, very simple. You know, I helped teach some people the kind of Bible studies that this guy does. And they came back to me and they said, you know, I've been wanting to give Bible studies all my life, but I could never remember enough. And it's so simple to study the Bible. What he does is he just reads stories. He starts in Genesis and he works his way through the Bible. And he reads a story with them, and then he closes the Bible and asks four questions. The first one is, what did the story say? What was the story? And then the people help each other out, try to remember what the story said. And then he says, well, what does it mean? And that's where they can try to apply it in their own lives. What does it mean? You know, apply it. Or interpretation. You know, they interpret it. What does it actually mean? And then he asks two more very, very important questions. First is, what are you going to do about it this week before we study again? And the people have to say what they're going to do. They have to make a commitment. I am going to, because of what I read, in response to what I read, I am going to do such and such. And then the fourth question that he asks is, okay, who are you going to share this with? Who are you going to tell this story to before we meet again next week? And just doing that very, very, very simple Bible study, he has baptized more people and planted more churches than just about anybody else I know. It doesn't require a degree in theology in order to be a missionary, in order to do this, in order to make disciples of people. Every Christian can do it. And there's another way. You know, Mrs. White tells a story, and I know I've said this before, but it's a story that bears repeating, of a young man. He was intending to go into foreign missions when he was young, but his father died, and he was forced to take over the family business in order to support his parents and his siblings. Well, years later, he told one of his friends, you know, I work for the Lord 24/7. All day long in all of my business relations, I try to represent Christ as best I can. And anybody who's interested, who's willing to, I will talk to them explicitly about Christ. And then at night while I'm sleeping, I support a missionary that works for me in China on the other side of the world. So I work for the Lord 24/7. This man wasn't an Adventist. And Mrs. White said, you know, commended him and said, why aren't there more Adventists who will do what this man is doing? Every single Christian can do this. And this is the purpose that we are called to. Well, moving on a little bit. So that dropped you there in my mid-early teens, I guess. At that point, I knew that I was called to work for God. To work for God in whatever career I chose. And, you know, I really appreciated my parents never told me I needed to be a missionary. They never pressured me that I needed to do the same thing that they did. And, you know, I intended for much of my life to get into aviation and hopefully get into NASA. I really, really intended to try for NASA. And, I did my research, figured out, you know, the best options, best chances to get into NASA and what career track I'd need to follow. Well, at this point, I decided, I realized that I probably wouldn't be able to keep the Sabbath. I probably ended up, you know, starting in the Navy and getting, working towards NASA. And either one of those careers, I probably wouldn't be able to keep the Sabbath. So I said, okay, well, I'll drop the whole NASA thing, but I still want to get into aviation. So I thought I'd be a mission pilot. Well, it wasn't more than a couple years later that I started hearing God whispering to me, and he said, you know, I have other people who can fly the planes, but the mission pilot is only as good as the missionaries on the ground that he's supporting. I have other people that can fly. I have prepared you specifically to be a missionary on the ground. That's where I want you. So I said, okay, you know, that's okay. It's not quite my plan, but, you know, I'm happy with that too. And it was about that time that my family came back on furlough. We were walking around Andrews campus with the director of Adventist World Aviation. And we got all excited talking about this people group. They had come and visited us. About this people group that was just south of the Alangan where I grew up working with my parents. They were called the Batangan. That's what we knew. And y'all know much of this story already. So I went over there and they sent me because I was the healthiest and knew the language the best, I guess. And I thought, you know, there's no way that I'll ever be able to be a missionary to these people. I really wanted to. At that point, I got excited, got hooked. But I said, there's no way that this project will still be open. Well, to make a long story short, when I was graduating college, nobody had yet gone to the Tawbeed, and so I applied and prepared. Well, all through the last 2 years of high school there and all through college, I did everything that I could to prepare myself, not just for missions, but specifically to reach the Tawbeed. I chose my electives in high school and my electives in college. I chose the jobs that I worked, everything that I could, I chose preparing myself specifically to reach the Tawbeed people. So I had been preparing for something like 7 or 8 years by the time that I arrived in the Philippines. And I was really excited when I got there. In September of 2011, I was excited. And finally, all these years I've been preparing, and I'm finally going to meet these people. And, they didn't really want to have much to do with me when I went to do the project survey. But I was only there for a week, and nobody knew me and whatnot. And it's going to be different this time. Well, when I arrived, they didn't want to have anything to do with me. They wouldn't. Not only would they not allow me into their territory, when I did meet some of them, they wouldn't talk to me. They wouldn't answer me when I talked to them. They wouldn't even look at me. When I would walk up to them, they would just keep on walking, pretending I didn't even exist. And I was banned from going into their territory at all. So I started working with the Alangan in the village where I grew up, the church leaders there, and they started traveling through Tawbeed territory. For 6 months, they traveled all around the Tawbeed territory, looking for a village, a group of people, even one person who would be willing to let me come and work with them. They didn't even want my help. They didn't want medicine. They didn't want anything. They just wanted me to leave them alone. 6 months in, God finally opened up the door for me to move to the village of Balangabung. So I moved there. I was kind of excited, but I was in for a rude awakening. There were actually some Adventists in that village. Surprise, surprise. We had known that there had been a few Adventists, years ago, but they had, as far as we knew, they had died out. We hadn't heard anything back from them. Well, it turns out that a few of them had held on, and they were living in the village of Balangabung, where God had opened the door for me to come in. I came in at the invitation of the district pastor, with approval of the conference and the union and division, all the way up. And as soon as I arrived, I found out later the only reason they ever let me in is they had a meeting, and they said, well, let's see what we can get out of this guy, and then we'll kick him out. Yeah. So when I arrived, let me back up a little bit. The church that was in Balangabung, that was planted there in Balangabung, was planted by a Filipino lady who lived in the lowlands right near the base of the mountains. And for 13 years, if I remember right, 13 years, she would kill chicken and cook a pot of rice every Sabbath. And she would invite all the Tawbeed down to eat. And while they were eating, of course, everybody loves free food. But while they were eating, she would preach at them. And she preached at these people every Sabbath for 13 years before she was finally able to win a few of them to Christ. But when she did, we call it Adventist animists. So, their heart religion is animism, where they interact with these spirits, the demons that live in the world. They do everything they can. We hear about American Indians calling for the spirits and whatnot. No. They do everything they can to keep those spirits away. They don't want to have anything to do with them. They want all of their incantations, all of their shamans are focused on getting rid of those spirits and all the evil that they bring. Excuse me. But that's the spiritual reality that they live with. They have the spirits, and then they have different things that they do to manipulate those spirits to keep them away. Well, when they became Adventists, they didn't understand the great controversy. Nobody explained it to them in a way they could understand. So what they did is they just replaced the spirits with God, and they replaced the different incantations and chants and manipulations. They replaced that with going to church the right way. So when I came, and I didn't know their order of service, I didn't know how they did things, so I didn't stand up at the right time, I didn't sit down at the right time and kneel at the right time, I didn't sing the right songs in the right order, I didn't say the right words and the right introductions and all these different things, and so I wasn't a Christian. They just replace manipulating the spirits with manipulating God through those things. And so almost from the second Sabbath I was there, almost from the first Sabbath I was there, actually, I was branded by the Adventists as a heretic. So the Adventists hated me. Well, there are Catholics in the village. The Catholics decided, yeah, it was okay. The Catholics decided that I was treasure hunting and prospecting for gold. And so they gossiped all around about how I was doing that and were trying to get me kicked out. Then there are some Protestants in the village, and they decided that I was a CIA agent, an agent of the CIA. They didn't even know what the CIA was, but it sounded bad. And so they started talking about it. And they actually went to the National Commission on Indigenous Peoples and lodged a complaint against me that I was doing these things. And they tried to get me kicked out there. And so, you know, half of my life at this point almost, I have been preparing to help these people. And they don't want to have anything to do with me. All they're trying to do is, now they let me in, they're trying to get me kicked out again. Well, this story happened one particular night. You can see my house. This is about a year in. You can see my house there. The termites did a number on it. The termites are really, really aggressive, as Dad can testify. You see there are poles here on the left side of the picture. Those poles are propping my house up. If those poles hadn't been there, the whole thing would have just slumped over as I was sleeping. It would have collapsed on me. You can see the railing of the porch is all leaning downhill. It's full of mold. It's so humid over there. You know, we think it's humid here. It gets humid over there. It doesn't actually get all that hot, but it can get so humid that it'll rain with no clouds. Just 100% humidity, and the water starts just coalescing out of the air and falls. And so, of course, everything is covered in mold. The mold is so aggressive over there, it can actually etch glass. So you, like, wipe it off your camera lenses? Well, it doesn't help because it's already etched the glass on your camera lens. It's actually kind of pretty, though, because it glows. It glows in the dark. But it stinks, and yeah, it eats up your clothes, eats up your towels. You get big holes just from the mold eating them. It's so aggressive. And I forgot to tell you. And then for 3 months at this point, I had been flat on my mat. I couldn't get up. I was so sick. And couldn't figure out what was going on. I'd called Mom, had treated myself as best I knew how, had done laboratory tests. Nothing was showing up that was wrong with me, but I was so sick, I couldn't get up and do anything. I was just on my mat for 3 months. You know, my partner, teammate, in America that means something different nowadays. My teammate, is the guy that I grew up with, you know, in the first picture there. He and his family moved down with me to help me there. He and I both noticed that when we would go down off the mountain, we would immediately start feeling better. And we would go down and rest up and build our health back up. And as soon as we started walking back up that mountain again, before we even got to the village, we would start feeling terrible again. And we started realizing this is Satan. He is trying to keep us away. And, you know, there was nothing physically wrong that anybody could find with me. I was just so sick I couldn't get up for 3 months. This particular night, I knew what was wrong with me that night. I had Giardia. And it's pretty bad. It gives you really, really bad diarrhea and bad cramping. It really hurts. You know, I've never had a child, but I think I can sympathize a little bit with the volume of pain that Giardia causes. And the problem was the medicine wasn't working. So I knew what I had this time, but the medicine wasn't fixing it. So I was just stuck with it. And so I was sitting there in my house, or laying there in my house on my mat, and the humidity is so thick, the air gets so thick, it's like it's pressing down on you. And this man comes up on the porch and calls out, "Taupo, brad, bradjan, bradjan." Brad is their way of shortening brother. So instead of saying bro, they'll say brad. And so that's my name there, bradjan. He says, "Come up." He came up on my porch and saying, "Bradjan, bradjan." And so I slowly picked myself up and walked out the door. And I was really weak. And so I was trying to lean against the house. Well, the house is leaning against me, too. So, you know, it's at this angle, and I'm trying to lean up against the wall, kind of hunched over like this. And he says, "Bradjan, will you give me 1,000 pesos? My kids don't like the food that I brought home for them tonight, and so I'm going to go buy them some tinapay." Tinapay is like junk food. So, you know, chips and, you know, salty chips and sweet chips and sweet bread and stuff like that. And he said, I want to go buy them some tinapay. And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't have that much money with me here." And they said, "Well, just give me 500 pesos. And I said, I'm sorry. And as I'm talking to him, he's looking past me into my house. And I know what he's thinking. He's looking. I have this, just a single little LED light bulb that I got out of, you know, the dome light of a car. So I got that out of a car and hooked it up to a little 12-volt battery. and a little solar panel up on the roof, and that's the only technology that I have in my house. But he's looking past me, and he's seeing that light bulb in there, and he's thinking to himself, okay, he has a light bulb, I don't have a light bulb. Therefore, he's richer than I am, therefore, he has to give me whatever I ask him. If he doesn't have the money, well, then he should go sell the light bulb and give me the money. The culture there is everybody has to stay on the same level. It's actually something that develops in a lot of different cultures when they're at the edge of survival, when they're on the verge of surviving or not surviving. And it keeps people groups alive. It happens a lot in Africa, too. And so it's really good for that. But the problem is once you get a little bit above that, above the survival level, it's really hard to build up the standard of living because everybody in the entire tribe has to come up at the same time. Nobody can get ahead a little bit and then help pull their friend up. Everybody has to stay at the same level. So they'll actually pull people down, force them to sell off what they have in order to distribute the wealth, you know, across the whole tribe. So when I describe this, a lot of people say, well, that's selfish. But it's just a different perspective. To them, we're really selfish, that I would actually allow myself to accumulate so much wealth more than somebody else and not give it away. You know, and they read Jesus talking about give to anyone that asks of you and whatnot. So it's just a different perspective. But I know what he's thinking as he's looking past me into my house and seeing my little light bulb there. He's thinking, you know, he's so rich, he should sell that and give it to me. And I'm sitting here, and my stomach is starting to cramp. The time bomb is ticking. And I know I have, you know, 30 to 40 seconds before it's going to explode. You can't control it once it comes. And it's hurting, too. It really is hurting. And he says, Brother John, just give me 300 pesos. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't. And now I'm thinking to myself, you know, the government gave you 2,000 pesos in welfare money yesterday. And you blew it on expensive restaurants and buying cell phones for your kids and bringing back really expensive food all in one day. He spent the whole 2,000 pesos in one day. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I bought roofing grass so I can fix this house of mine. I bought it from you 2 months ago and I paid you in advance and you still haven't brought it. You know, if you brought the roofing grass, I might be a little bit more lenient and a little bit more willing to work with you. That's what I'm thinking, you know, as I'm not really feeling very Christian right now with my stomach hurting. And he says, just give me 200 pesos. And I'm saying, I'm sorry, I can't. And he just turns around and walks away, doesn't take leave, which is very, very rude in their culture. But I don't even notice, hardly. I'm off that porch like a lightning bolt. And thankfully, it was night. Because at that time, there was only one village in the bathroom. And it was about a football field length away from my house. I wasn't going to make it that far. And thankfully, there was some brush nearby. And thankfully, it was night, so nobody could see me. And so I went out there, and it took about a half hour. Came back about a half hour later, back up onto the porch. And Mom tells me it's called the vasovagal effect. Your intestines are cramping, and it puts pressure on a nerve. And it makes you kind of like shock-type symptoms. You get really shaky, white as a sheet, and really, really weak, almost wanting to pass out. So I'm trying to come, you know, working my way back up to the house, up this hill, and onto my porch, and I get up onto the porch, and it's just, I can't go any farther. There's another step up into my house, and I can't even make it up into my house. I just fall down on the floor, just laying there, and, you know, white as a sheet, shaking, and another man comes up on my porch, and he's my church elder, and he says, Brother John, I just want you to know that everybody in the church is angry at you. And I said, well, thank you. That's all I needed to know right now. And he says, yeah, you know that lumber that you hired somebody to chainsaw for you? They hand chainsaw, you know, freehand chainsaw their lumber there. And so I had hired somebody to chainsaw this lumber, and then I had hired a taubweed, one of our church members, to haul it down out of the mountains for me. And he said, yeah, you gave the job to just one person. What you should have done is taken every board and divided it up among everybody in the village, one board per person, so that everybody gets a little bit of money. And so everybody in the church is angry with you. I said, well, thank you for letting me know. At least I know now why nobody talked to me at prayer meeting. Nobody would hardly even look at me at prayer meeting. And he kind of gets a concerned look in his face, and he says, are you okay, Brother John? And I say, yeah, I'll live. And he says, well, you know, you're reminding me. You know, there were eight missionaries who tried to reach us before you came. And let's see, there was the one who got sick all the time, and he couldn't handle it anymore, so he went home. And then there was the one who had a moral failing, and we kicked him out. And then there was the one who just stood up in church and cursed us and then walked out. And then there was the one who disappeared in the middle of the night. And I said, thank you, thank you. I very distinctly remember why every person who came before me failed. And you don't need to remind me again. And I said, okay, okay. Well, take care, Brother John. You know, at least he took proper leave before he, you know, walked off the porch. And so he left. And I'm just laying there in the dark, you know, shaking, weak, sick, stomach hurting. You know, the humidity is like an oppressive blanket pushing down on me, and the mold, the smell of the mold. And I'm thinking to myself, I've spent half of my life preparing to help these people. I've given up anything that I had to in order to help these people. I've made the choice, I'm willing to die to help these people. And they don't want to have anything to do with me. They don't want to have anything to do with me. They want to kick me out. They don't want my help. Why should I keep doing this? Why should I keep forcing myself to endure all this? And as I'm thinking this, these ants start to crawl all over me. And they have these ants over there. They're, you know, fire ants here in the States? Well, they're a little bit worse. You know why the scientists tell you that ants are related to wasps when you get bit by these things. They raise a welt on you, and they hurt for a long time. They hurt for about 10 minutes. And these ants started crawling all over me and in my clothes, and I'm so weak that I don't even have enough strength to smash them or to try to pick them off of me. So they're just sitting there biting me. And tears start welling up in my eyes, and I said, God, why? It's not worth it. Let me go home. Let me do something different. And you know, typically when we hear these kind of stories, mission stories, and at this point, God's supposed to step in. You know, you're supposed to see lightning. You're supposed to, you know, the missionary sense feels this overwhelming sense of peace. Or somebody comes up on the porch and you know, tells you how they've been led to Christ because of you or something like that. I think sometimes us missionaries may have done a disservice to people back home by always telling the miracle stories and not telling the stories of the times when God is just quiet. And when I was asking God there that night, when I was questioning my calling, he didn't answer. Nothing happened. There were no fireworks. There was no sense of peace. The ants just kept on biting. And I was still, you know, shaking. I just kept on going. And but I started to think, you know, after I got quiet, I started to think, well, you know, I made a vow. Before I ever went overseas, I made a promise to God that I would not leave the Taubweed until one of two things had happened. First of all, the project was done, which means that they are not only churches planted, but they're continuing to plant churches, continuing to grow, so that even after I leave, it'll continue to expand. Or number two, God very clearly removes me from this work. And those two things haven't happened. And I made a vow, and I can't go back on that vow. And so as I'm laying there in the dark, I started praying again, and I said, God, you know, sometimes it's easier to die for somebody than to keep on living and suffering for them. And if that's what you want, if that's what you need me to do, if you need me to just keep on suffering, well, then I'll do that. And I still didn't have any overwhelming sense of peace. There were still no fireworks or sudden miracles, but I did hear a whisper. And he said to me, carry on, soldier, carry on. Again, I think sometimes missionaries have done a disservice by making missions sound more romantic than it really is. I don't tell this story to try to convince you that life is harder over there or that life is more of a trial for me than for you. I actually had the opposite in mind, trying to help us back here understand that whether you participate in God's work there or whether you participate in God's work here. When you do that, when you start making disciples, Satan doesn't like it. And he's going to hit you as hard as he can. Remember Job. You know, he is going to make life miserable. William Carey, you know, the father of modern missions, arguably, you know, one of the greatest missionaries that's lived since Paul, he made this statement. He said, if the biographer gives me credit for being a plotter, then he will describe me justly. Anything beyond this will be too much. I can plod. I can persevere in any definite pursuit. To this I owe everything. Whether you're in the jungles of the Philippines, or whether you're working a 9-to-5 here, when Satan hits you, you just have to keep plodding. You just have to keep going. That doesn't mean you can't complain and whatnot. You know, Job complained a lot. He told God how terrible this was, but he didn't dishonor God. He didn't dishonor God, and he just kept on going. He didn't give up his faith. He kept on going. And you know, it came to the point where Satan had to back off. And that's something that Ramon, a lot of you have heard stories about Ramon over the years. Ramon taught me, and he said, you know, if you keep on pushing through, if you back off, Satan is going to keep hitting you with that over and over again because he knows it works. It works, and you back off. But if when the problem comes, when Satan hits you, if you just keep on going, just keep on pushing through, then after a while, typically Satan will back off again because he says, well, this isn't working. I'll have to try something else again. Just keep on going. Keep on pushing through. Well, invariably, people ask me, well, did you get well? Obviously, I must have gotten a little bit better because I'm standing here in front of you. But the simple answer is no. I didn't get well immediately. I was still sick. That particular episode lasted for probably a month. It took me about a month to get over that one. And my health has slowly built up, you know, over the years since that point. But it took a long time. And people still try to get me kicked out. It's every 3 to 6 months that I have another crisis that someone tries to kick me out. As many people and as many times as they've tried to kick me out, you know, going up to the government, it's only by God's grace. It's only by God's intervention, looking back on it, that I'm still able to be there at all. So I know that God still has a work for me to do there. But it was about 2 months after that particular incident happened that I started my very first baptismal studies. And I had several students who were interested in being baptized, and so it was for them. But I invited anyone else who wanted to learn as well, wanted to learn what we believed, to come along as well. Well, let's back up a little bit. When I first arrived to work among the Taubwid, the Alangan where I grew up and the Taubwid didn't really, they knew that the other tribe existed, but they didn't really have any connection. And especially the believers didn't know that there were other believers in either of the tribes. And both tribes really had a hard time finding young people for their kids to marry. Because not only just believers, but anyone that you're not related to even. Because they're such a small tribe. 20,000 seems like a lot, but still, when you only have 20,000 people in your gene pool, it's hard to find people you're not related to marry. Well, when I took some of the Alangan to go with me to the Taubwi, they discovered each other, and there was a rash of weddings between the two tribes. They don't really want to go out to the Filipinos because of a lot of bad history, and then also they tend to lose their land if they do that. But, you know, finding another native tribe that they could marry, they were excited about that. Well, so I moved down to the Taubwi, and they discovered each other. This girl from Balangabong went back to the Alangan territory to a village that I almost never go to. And she found a man there, or a young man, and she married him, hooked him and married him, and brought him back to the village where I was working. And he was pretty shy, and I tend to be shy too. We both had the Alangan heritage, so we both said hi and greeted each other in our heart language, and sort of second heart language for me. But anyway, that was about it. Well, when I was holding these baptismal studies, this guy shows up. His name was Angelo. And Angelo shows up, and he comes more faithfully than any of my students do. And he's always there early. So I thought that was kind of funny, but neat. I appreciated that. Well, again, we're both kind of shy, so we never really talked too much. But one night, we were both there really early, before anyone else arrived, we had been sitting there for maybe 15 minutes, and I guess it got awkward enough. He finally came up and started telling me this story. He says, you know, you saved my life. I said, wait a minute, you haven't come to the clinic. I've only known you a couple weeks now, and I've only seen you a couple times in those 2 weeks. What do you mean I saved your life? Well, back when I was in middle elementary school, my mom started teaching me to run the clinic. I didn't run the clinic per se, but she taught me how to treat people. So when they were traveling, I would be able to crack out the books and roughly, more or less, figure out what was wrong with people and try to calculate the dosages for the medicines that they needed. And I definitely didn't do this on a regular basis, but when they traveled and an emergency case came up, I would do what I could. Well, Angelo, when he was just a baby, Angelo's parents had brought him to Pandurucan, where I grew up. My parents were gone for some reason, I don't know why. And so they were hopeless. You know, the Filipino medical system has gotten better, but back in those times, if a native went to the hospital, they would stop him at the door. The doctor would stop him at the door, say, "That's far enough, I know what's wrong with you," and they'd write out a prescription for Tylenol. We had a lady that was it 14 months pregnant? Something like 14 months pregnant that took to the hospital, and that's what the doctor did. Wrote out a prescription for Tylenol and sent her back home. And Mom had to just do the best that she could and pray a lot, and she lived. Anyway, so Angelo's family said, you know, there's no hope. There's no point in even trying to go to the hospital. So since my parents weren't there, they were resigned that he was going to die. He was really, really sick. And the people in the village said, well, just, you know, go up to the house and see, because their son is there, see if he can help you. And so they did, and I cracked out the book, opened the books, and figured out most likely he had pneumonia, and found some medicine for him and sent him home with that medicine, and never heard back from him. In fact, I completely forgot that the incident ever even happened. Well, I don't know if it was because of the medicines. I think it was probably more of God's intervention than the medicines. I didn't really know how to calculate dosages very well for babies back then. I really do think it was because of God, you know, God's intervention. But anyway, Angelo lived. Angelo got better and he lived. And all those years growing up, his parents kept telling him, if you ever told him this story, and then told him, if you ever find that guy, you have to be whatever he is, and you have to do whatever he tells you to do. Okay, so I don't know for sure when that happened, but approximately 17 years later, I come back to the States for college, had gotten several calls. I had gotten calls to be a pastor here. I had gotten calls to teach here. I had gotten calls to teach in Thailand, but I chose to go back to the Philippines, but to a different tribe. So I went all the way back to the Philippines again, 17 years later, to a different tribe, a different village. And because I went back, those two tribes got together. A girl from that village went back to where I grew up, but to a village again that I never go to. Found this guy, hooked him, married him, brought him back again to the village where I'm living now. And when he walked into the village and saw me, he recognized me. He had been a baby, so I don't know how he recognized me, other than his parents' description or the Holy Spirit telling him. Anyway, he recognized me, but he didn't say anything. He was very quiet. He just tucked it away in the back of his mind. Okay, I need to watch him. And when he heard that I was holding these baptismal studies, he said, okay, that's what I need to do. And he came more faithfully than any of my other students. Oh, I missed a picture here. So this is me as a kid practicing my medical skills. And this is another picture of Angelo at camp meeting. A couple months after that baptismal series, at our Mungin camp meeting, where we get all the native believers together from the different tribes, Angelo was baptized. Yeah. So again, when you choose to participate in the great controversy on God's side, when you choose to fulfill, to do the commission that God has given us to do, to make disciples, one of the things that we as Christians find is that sometimes those seeds that we plant, it feels like we're just planting seeds and planting seeds and planting seeds and witnessing and witnessing and witnessing, but we don't see anything coming from it. You know, Mrs. White tells stories of missionaries who've worked all their lives and never saw anything come of it. It wasn't until after they died that almost the entire people group was led to Christ. But God has promised, and God does not lie. He says, for as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven, and do not return there, but water the earth, and make it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it. So when this happens to you, when you do participate in God's work, when it feels that you're not, you're not accomplishing anything, don't be discouraged. Keep on doing what God asks you to do. Keep on witnessing. Keep on participating in the great controversy on God's side. Keep on planting those seeds, and there will be a harvest. God has promised, even if we don't see it, there will be people in the kingdom because of what you have done. So just real quick, I always end up forgetting and leave people hanging. the Talmud work has grown quite a bit since that point. It's you know, Satan's fought all the way. But we do now have, we have the mother church in Balangabung that is much, much healthier than it was back then. They understand that you don't, salvation isn't just about singing the right songs in the right order and whatnot. We have two church plants now that are growing in two different villages, and we have two highland villages. So these are the people that are farther up that don't want to have anything to do with us, still don't wear clothes. They wear G-strings, that's it. So we have two highland villages now that are letting us come in regularly, letting us visit anytime we want to, and one of those is actually letting us tell Bible stories to their children. And so we, you know, the work is slowly progressing. God is continuing to work. I didn't think it would take this long. But again, you know, just keep on trudging, keep on plodding. Every Christian, no matter where you are, no matter what livelihood you have chosen, whatever talents God has given you, whatever career God has given you, we are to use that career in order to make disciples. When you do that, Satan's going to hit you hard as he can. You just have to keep on going. And don't get discouraged, because those seeds will bear fruit in God's time and in God's way.